Hello and welcome to this afternoon's session. We're going to get started first with Barbara Kornblau, School of Health Professions, Division of Occupational Therapy at Florida A&M University, and Carl Cooper, who is also at the American Association on Health and Disabilities in Rockville, Maryland. And they're going to be speaking on the law and social determinants of health, how public health law can decrease health disparities among the disability population.
Thank you. Okay, our objectives for this session. At the end of this session, you should be able to explain three ways public health law can decrease health disparities among the disability population and discuss how public health law can interface with disability law to improve public health for the population of people with disabilities. I apologize, we try and read our slides because of accessibility issues. We want everybody to have access to the information. So we'll try not to do it verbatim and give you the information that's on the slide, but that's something that we believe in. In 2009, the National Council on Disabilities, which is a quasi-governmental agency that provides policy information for Congress and the executive branch, came out with a study called The Current State of Healthcare for People with Disabilities. And the report said that people with disabilities experience significant health disparities and barriers to health as compared with people who do not have disabilities. They also found that people with disabilities are affected by all of the social determinants of health. They smoke more, they're more obese, they get less exercise, more of them are unemployed, and they live in poverty. I wanted to go through a few examples of the health disparities that people with disabilities experience. And though it's not part of this discussion, we found, and there's a lot of data to support, that people with disabilities who are also members of racial and ethnic minorities experience even greater health disparities. So 3 out of 5 people with serious mental illness die 25 years earlier than other individuals from preventable co-occurring chronic conditions that other people live with their whole lives, like asthma, diabetes, cardiopulmonary conditions, and some that cause death like cancer and heart disease, but some that are preventable. Inaccessible medical equipment and lack of trained physicians, dentists, and other health professionals prevent individuals with disabilities from receiving basic primary care that everybody takes for granted. Things like pap smears, getting weighed, pelvic exams, x-rays, physical exams, colonoscopies, and vision screenings. 27% of adults with major physical and sensory impairments are obese, compared with 19% of those without major impairments. Individuals with intellectual disabilities must contact 50 physicians before they can find one trained to treat them or willing to treat them. 4.6% of deaf individuals are infected with HIV/AIDS, which is the largest of any group, any population group. And 50% of those with TBI or spinal cord injuries are substance abusers. These two reports and the Surgeon General, IOM, bottom line is there are disability health disparities are a problem and we need to take action, and there isn't enough research being done in this area. Now, the background and context for this discussion. Since the passage of the New Deal social programs, Congress has used its spending powers to influence social policy. That came out of Halvering versus Davis. Congress has used financial incentives to achieve compliance with existing laws, especially in civil rights. We're going to show an example of one of those, and that was the case of Simpkins v. Moses Cone Memorial Hospital, where the Supreme Court found separate but equal unconstitutional, because hospitals receive funds under Hill-Burton, which was a federal law to help with hospital construction. This was a case that took place in the South where a dentist wanted to do surgery at a hospital. This hospital would take African Americans for certain procedures but would not allow doctors to be on staff. So this was a planned case that was brought by NAACP Educational Fund, and they won. And then after that happened, the Civil Rights Act passed. And the Civil Rights Act said that Title VI, no person in the U.S. shall be basically discriminated against on the basis of race, color, and national origin for any program receiving federal funds. Now, Medicare came, that didn't integrate hospitals. Even the Civil Rights Act passed, it didn't have any impact. So Medicare came in 1965. And before Medicare took effect in 1966, the Surgeon General told all hospitals that in order to enroll in Medicare, they had to certify in writing that they complied with Title VI. And they even sent out, there was a whole summer where they sent out medical students and law students to go out to these hospitals to see if they were actually complying. So the financial incentive of Medicare dollars integrated 92% of the nation's hospitals in a mere 4 months, and that's before the internet, while 300 hospitals chose not to integrate. Now, the relevant laws when you add disability to the mix are the Rehab Act, the Americans with Disabilities Act, changes in the Civil Rights Act, and the Affordable Care Act, or ACA. The Rehab Act covers recipients of federal funds. They can't discriminate based on disability. It also covers disparate impact. They must provide access to goods and services, and the Office of Civil Rights enforces this, or you can go with a private right of action. The ADA extended the Rehab Act protections. Oh, and federal funds, in this case, are Medicare and Medicaid, which is profound because now everybody gets them. The ADA extended the Rehab Act protection to private parties. It prohibits discrimination in providing services, including health care. You must provide reasonable accommodations to have access to that health care. But the problem is there are no ADA police, with some minor exceptions, so it's really incumbent upon the person to actually go after someone. And it specifically excluded insurance, so insurance companies could discriminate. Now, the Civil Rights Act changes happened in 2001, and some of you in the previous presentation by the law section may have heard about Alexander versus Sandoval, which was a case against in a southern state where they wanted language access for driver's license tests, and they said no. They sued, and because language is a proxy for ethnic origin, and the Supreme Court said no. You have to prove intentional discrimination, no more private disparate impact claims, that the regulation that said disparate impact could only be enforced by the Office of Civil Rights. Now, when that changed, the best thing was it didn't apply to ADA, the Rehab Act, or IDEA, which is the special education law. So IDEA Titles 1 and 3 of the ADA explicitly create a private right of action in the statutory language, and Title II was tested in Barnes versus Missouri, where they said there's no punitive damages under the ADA Section 202, but there is a private right of action, and you can get attorney's fees. So the Affordable Care Act has been called by Representative Clyburn the Civil Rights Act of the 21st century. In the bill, there are specific sections that talk about health disparities, data collection, cultural competence, training the workforce, anti-discrimination, and closing the ADA insurance gap. And these all mention disabilities. So we made a lot of progress. Now, the anti-discrimination provisions of the bill say you can't discriminate on the grounds of or anything prohibited under Section 504 of the Rehabilitation Act. So it also says some other things, but I'm just talking about the disability portions. So it's interpreted the same way the Rehabilitation Act is. In any health programs, any program that gets federal funds dealing with health, any financial assistance, any activity that's administered by an executive executive agency. So what does 1557 do? It removes the ADA exception that allowed discrimination in health coverage. It gives a private right of action because the 504 has one. Now, it hasn't been tested, but it says we're doing everything according to 504. It's written there, and we know under 504 that there is a private right of action. So it gives a tool to challenge these sections, these cultural competency, health disparities, workforce training, and research funding as discriminatory if disabilities is not included. And that's profound. Any workforce training programs that are doing cultural competence have to include disabilities. It's in the bill. Other implications for the Affordable Care Act: inaccessible medical equipment is one of the causes of health disparities, and we've come out with, there are voluntary standards on that that were set by the Access Board. So one of the things we're wondering about going forward is, will the ADA plus ACA's now voluntary standards change the standard of care? So if I go to the doctor, and the doctor transfers me and drops me because his table's not accessible, what's the standard of care? He didn't have an accessible exam table, and there are standards, though at this point voluntary. Will that become the standard of care going forward? And the other thing that's important is that access to coverage, because all the health disparities researchers in race and ethnicity and all the other, when they look at us, they say, you don't have disparities, you're all covered. People with disabilities have Medicare and Medicaid. Well, access to coverage doesn't mean access to care, especially for people with disabilities. If you don't have a sign language interpreter, if you can't get on the table. And I'm going to turn this over to my colleague, who is going to talk to you about a program that's been going on with... where do you need to transfer from? Okay. There's a program that he's going to talk about that Robert Wood Johnson Foundation funded for navigator assistance for people with disabilities, and we have data that's come out of his project.
Thank you. First of all, yeah, my name is Carl Cooper. I'm the project manager for the National Disability Navigator Resource Collaborative, which is a project funded by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation to provide training and technical assistance to navigators and other enrollment specialists as they're assisting individuals enroll in the insurance marketplaces with the exchange, and specifically to give them the technical and technical assistance and a level of competency on disability issues. In terms of some of our observations after year one, some of the things that we found in terms of where some disparities still existed in terms of getting people enrolled in coverage. First was on behavioral and mental health, where we found a lack of providers and network adequacy in the marketplace plans. These consumers usually also fail to self-identify, thereby making it more challenging to provide that assistance as well. We also found that in terms of, by and large, the biggest inquiry we got from navigators was, how do I assist a consumer enrolled that is deaf or hard of hearing in terms of paying for sign language interpreters? And this comes down to basically the issue of funding. The navigators wanted to do the right thing, but it's just, how do we pay for it? And that became a real issue in terms of trying to find the funding for that. Next is the prescription drug formularies, and getting access to the formularies is a big issue. And the limitations within the formularies are both issues that disproportionately affect individuals with disabilities. So many times when you talk about drug formularies, there'll be tiered benefits when it comes to drugs in terms of what drugs are on a higher tier and therefore cost more to the consumer in terms of copays and the like. And these have a disproportionate effect on people with disabilities, as many of the specialty drugs that people with disabilities take are usually on the higher tiers. In terms of habilitation and rehabilitation benefits, there are concerns over limiting the number of visits. As we all know, under the Affordable Care Act, one of the provisions of the Affordable Care Act was getting rid of the monetary caps that were placed on insurance coverage. What that does not do is get rid of service limitations that the insurance companies will put on. So they are allowed to still limit the number of therapy visits people can go to and the like. And they're using that as a way to limit the number of rehab and habilitation therapies that people with disabilities receive. And this obviously has a disproportionate impact on those populations. Take, for instance, if something happens and you break your leg and you need rehab, as a result of that, it's not a big deal for you to go to the rehab and probably abide within the limitations for the rehab therapies. But for a person with a disability that requires that rehab for maintenance, they need that to be able to continue to function and exist on an ongoing basis. They're never going to stop using that rehab therapy like someone else would. As a result, those limitations have that disproportionate impact on those people with disabilities. Another issue that we've noticed is enrollment accessibility in terms of actually what the navigators are doing and trying to assist the individuals with enrolling. And generally, for instance, one of the issues we have is obviously the offices generally that the navigators are in are usually very accessible, and that's generally not the issue. The issue is when they go out and they have, as they've been doing a lot of outreach in the communities, they hold community events out in the public, a community fair or a county fair or something like that, and they're not always in accessible locations. And then the bigger issue, actually, when it comes to accessibility issues, is formatting the materials. So having things in Braille and large print and other alternative forms of communication to be able to assist those consumers is an ongoing issue. And then finally, durable medical equipment, which includes breathing equipment, screen readers, wheelchairs. And this is basically, it's a challenge for some consumers who use a DME or assistive technology to find out what is and what isn't covered. I always used to use myself as an example of this. Obviously, I use a wheelchair. I enrolled in coverage through the Maryland Exchange, and I knew to ask the questions. I knew who to ask, and I still had a hard time getting the answers to the question as to what was covered and what wasn't. So imagine a consumer that doesn't even know they should be asking the questions or doesn't have the complexity that maybe some of those of us that are have a little more experience dealing with insurance companies in terms of what they have to do and where they deal with that. So where do we go from here? In terms of the solutions, first of all, these issues all come under a combination of the ADA, the ACA, and Section 504, which is the Rehab Act, and all federal funds that all recipients of federal funds have to abide by these. One of the things that we would point out in terms of receiving federal funds, those insurance companies that are participating in the marketplaces are receiving federal funds because they're getting the premium tax credits. So that's the way to get in terms of the Section 504 and the Rehab Act, is they are receiving federal funds because of the tax credits that are built into the to ACA. In terms of possible choices of where we could go in terms of trying to bring about some of these solutions, one is to file an administrative complaint with HHS's Office of Civil Rights under Section 504 or the Affordable Care Act. Also, another thing of interest is OCR is currently in the process of writing the Section 1557 regs. Section 1557 is what Barbara talked about, the non-discrimination provision. So they're always looking for input on that, and we have some of the data that we're going to be providing them, and we're also looking specifically into how it will affect research. For those of you who do disability research or do health law research, how that research that's being done, how that is being, whether or not that's being done fairly and in a non-discriminatory fashion as it relates to people with disabilities. And then finally, Section 1557 litigation. We can just actually, we've talked about trying to find a test case where someone had a disproportionate impact on them as a result of something that's happened, and finding basically a modern version of Simpkins v. Moses Cone Hospital. So that would be essentially for the insurance company. So finding some insurance company that has denied treatment or has a plan that is set up in a way that on its face doesn't appear discriminatory, but when you look at its actual effect, it has a disproportionate impact. So in summary, people with disabilities obviously experience health disparities and are affected by the social determinants of health. As Barbara said, access to coverage does not equal access to care. So while the Affordable Care Act was a huge step forward on these issues and was able to really give us some of access to the coverage that those of us that have been shut out of the market in the past now have, it doesn't necessarily mean that we're still receiving the care that we need. Section 504 and ACA provide the vehicles to address these factors that affect people with disabilities and are traditionally thought to decrease the health disparities. Thank you.